Today, we live in a world that is extremely skeptical about the claims of the Bible. In fact, the world is involved in myths today. We have all kinds of myths around, just like we did in the past, by the way. In the past, they talked about strange animals. When people would travel to foreign countries, they'd come back and they'd say there were people with faces on their chest or sitting there on their stomach or something like that. It's strange what people get involved in. They used to think, too, that light came about just from the ground. You know, all these bugs and whatever, or single cells or whatever, they just came by themselves. They didn't realize that life only came from pre-existing light. And so, unfortunately, we've got all kinds of theories and ideas taught in schools that go directly against the Bible. So today we're going to talk about the evidence of creation. That's the title of today's sermon. The evidence of creation, or the evidence for creation. We have a handout here now. Albert's going to give you a handout. The Bible is dogmatic about it. Let's go to Exodus 20 and verse 11. There's all kinds of scriptures there, of course. I just thought I'd review a couple with you today. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Verse 8, Exodus 20, verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So the Bible reveals that God is the creator. Let's go to another scripture that even shows a little more. Not only did God create the world, brethren, but the Bible indicates that God maintains the world. Isaiah 42 and verse 5. Thus says the God, the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out and spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those on it. So God is the one that maintains the earth. It indicates that God is the one that maintains, like, the law of gravity and all of that. One more scripture here, Colossians 1 and verse 16. Who was it that did the creating then? Well, it was Jesus Christ. Colossians 1 and verse 16. For by him all things were created, that is, in heaven and the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. So all things were created. The law of gravity and the speed of light and all of those things are in effect, and they were created by God. Now, let's go on and get a definition of the theory of evolution. I looked it up in dictionary.com. Evolution. Biology, change in the gene pool of a population from generation to generation by such processes as mutation, natural selection, and genetic drift. Now, actually, they didn't really give what evolution's there. I mean, everything evolved. They don't just believe that the universe was created and then life came. They believe it starts with the Big Bang, and there was some kind of a Big Bang. And we don't want to go into that too much today, but there's a lot of problems with that, too. But there is one scripture that I read that some people use, and the Bible says God stretched out the heavens. So that could indicate, you know, some indication of the beginning. We really don't know. The one thing we have to realize about creation, brethren, we don't know how God did it. That's one thing. We know he did it, but it doesn't say how. You know, it doesn't say, well, you know, God did this or God did that. It doesn't even say that at all. It just says God created the heavens, the earth in the story. And to a certain extent, it is obvious that God meant for us to discover and look. You know, we all have this inquisitive mind. There's nothing worse, and we wonder why kids are getting in trouble with pot and all these things today. Why? Because they don't have something to occupy their minds. And why is it that you go to the airport and all these people are, you know, on their iPhones and on their, you know, Androids and all of this stuff? Why? Because our minds, you know, we naturally try to think. In fact, while I'm speaking right now, a lot of you could be thinking about all kinds of things, right? Boy, what a rotten speaker he is or something like, you know. Well, what a boring sermon, you know. It could be, oh, what a great sermon. It could be that. You know, our brains work a lot faster than I can talk, believe it or not. They do. They work a lot faster. It's an incredible thing. So, again, evolutionists, one of the intriguing things for evolutionists, it's very enticing for those who are intellectual. Why? Because they have answers, see. And that's where they'll criticize the creation. Well, you can't tell how God created it. But we want to know how. We want to know how it works. So that's one of the things that comes out of the problem. Evolutionists attempt to explain everything by chance. Everything. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is, whether we exist, what, you know, like morals. You know, they'll try to explain it that way. We evolved, and therefore we got these morals because, you know, these morals work better for this and that than that or whatever. They always try to put everything back to the theory of evolution. And so the idea also, brethren, has terrible ramifications and outcomes. You know what those outcomes are? Drugs. Purposelessness. Hopelessness. That's what it is. It's amazing. And so the Bible actually has some things to say about the intellectuals. And by the way, I'm not saying that everybody there is some high IQ, but a lot of them are. You know? A lot of them are. A lot of them are these tremendously intellectual people that are involved in that today. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 1. And the Bible does tell us why. It tells us why people get involved in this kind of thing. And it actually gives us a warning. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 18. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. As Mr. Allman mentioned in the sermonette today, you know, the rich and the poor, they're both created by God. And they all, by the way, without God or you know, the natural consequence, unless Christ returns, of course, they all have the same ending, don't they? Death. So, notice one verse 19 then. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. So, let's look at it this way. We see a world today that's really in science. And science, brethren, has done wonderful things for us. By the way, I really appreciate science. Look at those lights, those fluorescent lights up there. Right? In fact, if we wanted to today, and we didn't do it today, but sometimes, like Sharon, when she's up, you know, at Iris Place up there, we go ahead and we hook them up by phone. Remember the days before cell phones? Remember those days? And you'd get stuck on the road and you didn't have any way of calling. Now you get stuck on the road, well, you just get on your phone, you call and say, send me a tow truck. You know, whatever. Remember the days before 911? I mean, that's a really wonderful technical thing because you can dial 911, bang, on your home phone, if it's got to be a landline, by the way, then they know exactly where you are. So, you know, science has done wonderful things. I remember my cousin one time, he was down in Texas. And you know, I think it was in the Air Force, and one of the Air Force bases down there. He told me it was before the days of air conditioning, okay? Air conditioning, and he told me he'd wake up in the morning in Texas, and his bed would be wet with sweat, be soaked. Well, boy, when I was in Texas, it was the later 60s. For whatever reason, I had air conditioning, early 60s. And 60, I guess it would be later, 65, something, 64. Anyway, we had air conditioning. Boy, is that wonderful. If you lived in South Texas, near Kingsville, like where I lived, it was really something. So, you know, that's a wonderful thing. And it does, it makes our lives, you know, better, doesn't it? We do appreciate that. But what's going on here? I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Well, Stephen Hawking is one of those guys, isn't he? Super intellectual. Doesn't really believe in God. You know, it's really sad. I mean, there's something about the super intellectuals are the ones that seem to come up with this. Now, I'm sure there are others also, don't misunderstand me. But even religious leaders now, They believe in evolution. And they'll say, well, you know, God used evolution to create the earth. And all the difficulties are made up. Say, well, that's how God works. But that's not what the Bible says. The Bible indicates a sudden creation. Bang, just like that. And by the way, we're going to see that that's also the record of science, but the scientists won't admit it. Notice, for since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. And again, in verse 20, has God not made foolish, verse 20, the wisdom of this world? You know, you can get so smart that you get foolish, can't you? You know, you can get so smart and that you just don't even know. By the way, think about who did Christ work with? Did he go up to the Pharisees and say, well, I'd like to have a couple members of Sanhedrin be one of my apostles or disciples? Did he do that? No. He grew up in a little town, Bethlehem, and well, they went to Egypt and they came back. Eventually ended up in Capernaum. You know, and who did he call? Peter was a fisherman. He may not have been able to read or write. We don't know. John, one of the intellectual arguments against John the Apostle writing the book of John, guess what it is? Well, John was not educated, so he couldn't have written that sophisticated way. By the way, have you ever heard a truck driver writes poems or something? Really? Yeah? Huh? Sure. That's not always true, is it? You know, just because somebody's a carpenter doesn't mean that he doesn't do anything. Well, basically, that's what Craig Harper is. And whether he likes it or not, I think he's pretty intellectual. Okay? You know? He does pretty good. I mean, you can hear his sermon next. You can tell he's a well-read guy and all that. And all of you. I mean, and you know, sometimes people have the stigma of West Virginia. And that's not true, is it? People here are basically well-educated and whatever. And there's always the others, too, of course. But they were fishermen. He went. They were fishermen, he called. He called. Christ himself was a carpenter. Oh, but these guys couldn't know the truth. See, that was a big obstacle for the Pharisees. And that's one of the first things they bring up in the book of Acts. And they say, well, these are unlearned men. Who are they to tell us about our morality? Well, they were because they were corrupt. All right, what is science? The word science, brother, if you look it up, it really only means knowledge. In fact, let's go to 1 Timothy 6 and verse 20. It means knowledge. But unfortunately, it has crossed over in the intellectual world today. The word science equals evolution. That's the crossover has come. The word science equals evolution. And as we know, because science has been so successful, and these same science or physicists and others like Stephen Hawking, they come up with these intellectual things, and Einstein was a great scientist. By the way, he believed in God somewhat, and he talked about that in some of his writings. So Einstein was a little different than the modern ones. And by the way, some of the original scientists, Galileo and others, were strong believers in God. And actually, evolutionists will say today, this is basically a quote, I can show you where it is if you'd like, but some of them will say, well, that creationists hold back science. Now, I'm not talking about young earth creation. I'm talking about any kind, intelligent design. They don't care. You know, I know some people used to say that the young earth creation are really messing things up because they got the earth young. But then they came out with the intelligent design people, and guess what? The courts have kicked out of the schools also. It doesn't matter to them. They just don't want God. Okay? So notice here, 1 Timothy 6 and verse 20. Again, a warning from the Scriptures. O Timothy, guard what is committed to your trust, avoiding the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. And I think the old King James says science there. But you have to, I'm sorry, I didn't look that up. But it's the same thing. What do they say? We've got knowledge. Oh, we know better. Oh, God didn't create anything. It was all just by accident. You know, if you had a crime, brethren, and there's one guy, you know, and he's hated this guy. Let's take, sadly, the case that happens so often. Some guy murders his wife, right? Who's a prime suspect? You know, sadly. And sometimes it's wrong, and it can be wrong, but here's a guy. He's got his fingerprints on the gun. They find the gun in his house. There's a witness he says is there. Then the prosecutor said, well, we're not going to consider that the husband is a candidate for this crime. But that's what scientists have done. They've actually said, we will not. They won't put it this way. But they said, this is science, therefore you can't have God. But that's an oxymoron. Let me read you. This is from the Salt Lake City Tribune in May the 9th, 1999. Only 40% of scientists believe in God and the afterlife. And by the way, astronomers, you would think, what does the Bible say in what, Psalm 19? The stars show God's glory. You know what astronomers' rate is for belief in God? 7.5%. I'm sure it's worse today. See? And they start studying the universe and life. They come from schools where there's a heavy influence. In fact, creation cannot be even taught in schools. There was a place in Seattle, a school teacher, I think, in Seattle, who started mentioning Lamarck's embryos. You know, this one of these early scientists, evolutionary scientists, he actually tore the limbs off of embryos so it looked like they evolved. And you can't even mention that. You can't mention anything that goes against evolution in schools, in some schools. Now, it does vary, by the way. Because when I was in Salt Lake City, I used to go up in Idaho, and some of the schools in Idaho, they actually taught creation. So it varies, by the way, by area. So in some places, you might be able to do it. Probably less now, you know, than ever. All right, let's go to Psalms 14 and verse 1. Notice what the Bible says about those who make up their minds. Brethren, it's not a matter that these guys went to the scientific evidence and say, boy, it's obvious that there's no God. Believe me, they haven't done that. In fact, in one of the articles that that question came up, one of the gals in the church, young ladies in the church, had gone to a science class. And this science teacher was very evolutionist, says, creation means this or something. Put the word creation in. And immediately, she changed her terminology. No, evolution created it. She used the term creation, that these were created, and then, boom, right away. You see, brethren, creation, honestly, brethren, is obvious. It's obvious. Let's go to Psalm 14 and verse 1. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And now, it also continues. Notice the next part of the verse. They are corrupt. In fact, some of the early evolutionists actually said, I want to believe in evolution because I don't want anybody telling me what sexual morals I should have. And look it up for yourself. Let's look up. I think the guy's name is Huxley. Okay, you can look it up. It's amazing. They don't realize it. You know, but they are trying to explain everybody by chance. I'm sorry, I was looking for a bigger boat, and I should have talked to Craig Harper because he got some big ones. But all right, this is what the evolutionists are saying. Okay, this is a boat, and this is a nut. I'm going to set it right here. You can look at it if you can see it. I know it's too little small. Try to get a bigger one next time, okay? How long do you think it would take for this nut, just sitting there, to screw on? Like that. How long? Anybody want to guess? What would your guess be? Never. Oh, I'm sure if this building stood here long enough, it would probably fall down. Maybe we'd have an earthquake and it would roll on the ground. But you think it would roll and screw this thing on? Like that? Nice and tight? I could have put something in here, maybe nice and tight. But brethren, the single cell does stuff that makes this look like a incidental toy. All the time. It's just amazing. But this is what they believe. And not only that this one happened, but millions of times over and over and over and over again. They never put it in practical places. Some of the creationist books that you will see, the intelligent design books, The Design of Life is one of my gut, and it's a very good book, and he mentions how they give these stories. Oh, this could have happened. Reminds you of, you know, some guy in court. You know, maybe this guy, oh, I just happened to have blood on because I was butchering an animal or something. You see what I mean? You ever heard the lawyers that do those stories in court? For some guy that's obviously guilty, they'll come up with a story and say, man, how could that ever happen? When the logic is, you had the gun, you owned the gun, you were mad at your wife, and she's dead, who's the logical guy? But in the world, by the way, that's what evolutionists do with creation. They say, it can't be created. They make up their minds before they ever start. You know, and it's so sad. And again, I'll set this here. We'll see if it screws on by itself, okay? But brethren, inside the cell, there are little elevators that go up and down. The proteins move around. They move this and they move that. This is nothing. This is a simple thing. What they do in the cell, we just discovered. Okay? All right. Here's another thing to recognize. Science changes. Science changes. A guy named Pasteur, you ever heard of him? We call it what? Pasteurized milk? Because what, you boil the milk or whatever, and it makes it so that people do get sick. It's okay if you want to get natural, whatever, but sometimes somebody gets sick. And there's a reason why they do that. And that's another point. I want to go into that today, but, you know, people can make up their own minds on that. But Pasteur proved that life only comes from pre-existing life. The little bug in your yard, I'm sorry, or some bug, another bug laid an egg or something. You know what I mean? I mean, whatever. Amoeba comes from another amoeba. Bacteria comes from another bacteria. You know, it's amazing. Let me read you. This is from Encarta, I think, here. Under article Louis Pasteur. Fully aware of the presence of microorganisms in nature, Pasteur undertook several experiments designed to address the question of where these germs came from. Were they spontaneously produced in substances themselves, or were they introduced into substances from the environment? You see, in the early 15, 16, 17, early 1800s, they thought that these bacteria and everything came about by themselves. They didn't know. And the microscopes and things that they had, they couldn't tell. They couldn't see the cell. They thought they were blobs or something. They didn't realize how complex a single, I'm talking about not many, a single cell. Bolt, have you got on there yet? Come on, Bolt, you know. But that's what they believe. They're telling you that this Bolt can go on by itself. See? But Pasteur told them the same thing. Life only comes from pre-existing life. And it was a myth, a middle-aged myth, to say that life came about by himself. And by the way, when Pasteur did these experiments, did they say, oh boy, that's great. Yeah, you're right, Pasteur. You've proven it. No. This is back to the Encarta article. Felix Bouchet, and later the noted English bacteriologist Henri Bastian, who maintained that under appropriate conditions, instances of spontaneous generation could be found. Well, guess who was proven wrong? Remember that, they put it in the article. Remember Pasteur had these little canisters or little tubes that he put? Remember, and he put one in and he put a cover on it. And then the other, he left it open. And then he came back a few days later. And, of course, the one that was covered, you know, it was okay, didn't have any bugs. The other one had all kinds of them. See? So he proved it. But guess what's happened today? Another scientific myth, brother. Now, one of the biggest problems that evolutionists have is the origin of life. If any of you want to read on this further, this is one of the best books you can get, called Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe. He's got some great quotes in here. And by the way, he's not a young earth creationist. He's a biologist, by the way, I think, from Ohio. I'm trying to remember where he's from now. Anyways, a biologist, not too far from here, by the way. He's a biologist. And he started looking at it and examining and started thinking about it. And he's not a young earth creationist. Now, he might believe in God. I think he probably does. But, you know, he's just one of those guys looking into it. And life itself, brethren, at the very smallest level, is very, very complicated. This is another book called Evolution, A Theory in Crisis by Michael Denton, page 250. Molecular biology has shown that even the simplest of all living organisms on Earth today, bacterial cells, are exceedingly complex objects. Now, let's go back to Darwin's theory of evolution. How does it state that life started? Well, they say we're getting better, right? They say that life started out really simple in some primeval pool, and we got some lovesick amoeba that got together, and, you know, all of a sudden, you've got life. But wait a minute. I want you to show me that. You know, if we went to Mars and we found, let's say we went to Mars and the Highway 50 bridge down here in Parkersburg, right? Just south Parkersburg here. You found the bridge in a road. Would anybody ever assume that that evolved? I've used the example of a TV set. You can take anything, you know. Mount Rushmore. What if you went to Mars and they said, oh boy, there's Roosevelt up there? And so somebody would say, oh yeah. Oh, that is evolved. Would anybody even claim that? And by the way, remember on Mars they found a face or something on there? They thought at one time, and then they proved later it was just shadows and all of that. People were excited, and UFO guys were going crazy, and all of that. And then NASA got another picture of it from a different angle with the sun, and it didn't look like that at all. But notice what people will do. They go to Mars, and what do they expect? What are they looking for? Life. But by the way, which one can we make? Can we make a bridge? Or can we make a bacterial cell? You know what the answer is? No. We haven't made that. But they expect to find that. You see, the logic is so sad. Anything that you go down the road, I mean, if you go, let's say you go into a house, you find a clock. One man actually used the example of a clock, I think a watch, the blind watchmaker. Some people have tried to attack that. But would anybody ever assume, you go in the desert and you find a watch, and say, well, I wonder how many millions of years it took for that watch to evolve. You see the point? I mean, reason tells you. Logic tells you. Also, brethren, if you're in a courtroom and the defense lawyer gets up and says, well, did you exclude anything else? Did you consider anybody else? And said, no, we never did consider anybody else for this crime. Would that be logical? What's the first thing they do? Let's take that, Flight 370. What were they doing? They went through all the passengers, didn't they? We want to check. And right now, they might find something different later, but they could not find any passenger that was likely to do this. And the only one, actually there's only two alternatives left, I think. You know, again, it might change tomorrow, so don't quote me on this. But one of them is one of the pilots said something, or there was a mechanical failure, and everybody died on it, and it flew by itself, which it can do, by the way. So, you know, they don't really know. And they won't even know if they get the flight recorder because it only goes 2 hours and it flew, 6 or 8 hours afterwards. So, but notice when you're trying to find truth, you know, we're looking for the truth about Flight 370, aren't we? From Malaysia. We want to know the truth. So you can't exclude anything. But that's what scientists have done with God. They have excluded it. They said, we won't consider this. They'll basically state that. You know, I saw one paleontologist who was in England somewhere. Well, this idea that God could create, that's really stupid. It is. You know, Galileo, Newton, and all these men believed in God. So they were stupid. See? There was something wrong with them, and that doesn't make any sense. All right. Origin of life experiments. Once in a while, you will hear somebody say, oh, we did this experiment. One of the most famous of them is a guy named Miller and Urey, U-R-E-Y, I think it was, in Chicago in the early 1900s. They put some stuff in a tube, and they put some electrical in, and they got amino acids. Oh, so that proved life evolved, except there's a problem. What are we mainly made of, brethren? You ever hear about it in the food industry? Protein! The proteins are what? You know, we eat protein because that's good for you and all that stuff. Yeah. Proteins are made up of many, many amino acids. And they're shaped in a certain way. It's amazing. Origin of life experiments. You're either believe in magazines that scientists have created life. Wrong. What they do is they borrow DNA. That's what they do. They borrow DNA from a living form, and then they create something else. I mean, even some of these crossbreeds and all that stuff, you know, is just something they've done. This is a quote from in Michael Behe's book right here. It says, page 190, here's this quote, "No proponent of complexity theory has yet gone into a laboratory and mixed a large variety of chemicals in a test tube and looked to see if self-sustaining metabolic pathways spontaneously organize themselves." In other words, let me give this. Elevators going up and down, proteins moving here and moving there, made to fit each other, reproducing themselves. DNA and RNA. They haven't even gotten close. In fact, the Miller-Urey experiment where they did this and they put this stuff in a test tube, guess, you know, oxygen and carbon. Oh, no, they didn't put oxygen in there. And that's part of the lie. Because we know from geology. Now they ignore science. We know from geology that there was oxygen in the early atmosphere of the earth. They've proven it by their billions of years, and there's oxygen. We know that. Oh, but they didn't put oxygen in their little test tube, you know, with their carbon molecule or whatever. And guess what happens when you put carbon and oxygen together and you put electricity on them? What happens? Boom! The experiment would have blown up. Yet they say, oh, this is quoted in the books even till this day. You can look it up. You'll find, oh, this is a famous experiment, and this proved how life could have evolved by itself in a primeval soup. Well, I'm sorry. You know, it doesn't work. Okay? All right. Notice this is what he says. Michael Behe continues in his quote. "If they ever do try such an experiment, they will be merely be repeating the frustrating work of origin of life scientists who have gone before them, who have seen that complex mixtures yield a lot of muck on the size of a flask and not much else." This guy is an expert in the field, brother, writing this book. But they'll lead you to believe that, we can. See, the origin of life, brethren, is actually the Achilles heel of evolution. It is, because, you know, when you can look at, let's say our little kitty cats, okay? One of them's a little bigger than the other. And you see them sit down, and when they sit on the little table in front of me or on the chair or whatever, and it reminds me of Africa. And you see the lions. They look exactly in the same pose. They're smaller, of course. And then, you know, you get all kinds of, you know, you got leopards, you've got panthers, you got all of these variations, probably from Noah's Ark. That was one of the problems of that Noah's Ark picture, by the way. They had billions of animals coming in, and, you know, they only had to put probably one kind of cat. We know that. Because what happens is animals and humans themselves, that's why the Africans and Africa are black because it's an adaptation. Believe it or not, you would think the black would make it worse, but it doesn't. It's an adaptation so the sun doesn't bother them as much. And also they don't get malaria. There are other adaptations they've had. That's why some of them get sickle cell anemia, because it's an adaptation, because they do better with malaria than we do. Even they both get it and they can both die, by the way. Don't misunderstand. But, you see, you can make small cats into big cats and all of this. But what nobody's ever done is make a cat into a dog. They haven't done that. But they'll claim, oh, yeah, well, we got microevolution, and sooner or later it's going to happen, right? Sooner or later it's going to happen? Huh? The DNA has to be changed. You know, one of the most difficult things for evolution to explain is whales. Because you know what their story on whales is? Remember the old booklet we had in the church, Whale the Tail? Now, see, our noses are on the front, okay? So they claim that some kind of primeval creature decided to go back into the sea after it come out of the sea. Now, by the way, why would you go back into the sea? And they'll say, well, maybe predators got him. But what happens to, well, let's not get into that. It doesn't make any sense. But, okay, now, humans and mammals give birth what? Head first, for good reason, right? So a little baby comes out and can breathe and all of that. In fact, the head's on the little baby. My dad was really scared about me when I was born. Probably stay scared all his life. But my head was a point, because mom had a real hard time. Yeah, God has designed this head, you know. So when you're born, it can move, and well, I think I turned out basically okay. All right, amazing. All right, now you got a mammal, all right, and it's a whale. It's the first whale, but unfortunately, she gives birth head first. So the little old whale comes out and takes a breath of air. That's his last breath, isn't it? Guess what they do? They give birth in reverse. Not only that, you've got to put the nose behind the head, right? A dog, cat, whatever it is, whatever kind of whale creature they got. Yeah, and for some reason, he decides to go in the sea. And, oh, by the way, get sonar, too. Like dolphins do. Again, the Whale of the Tail booklet. What a good booklet, huh? How does that happen? Well, it happens. We know because we can see. We're smart. You are? Yeah, so were these guys that fought Pasteur. They were smart. One of them, remember, was one of the great bacteriologists of his day. And yet he was wrong. How many times can intellectual people make stupid decisions? They do, don't they? They do. Doesn't matter whether it's a president or a professor in a university or whatever. They get in their little group. That's what happens. And what's happening to us too, brethren, is it used to be that, you know, you went out and you milked the cows. And actually, you'd see cattle born or pigs born when I was a kid. We had pigs, you know. We'd see that. And you'd go out and you'd raise the wheat and the corn and the oats and all of that. And you'd be out in nature. But now where are they? They're sitting in a classroom with computers all around them, aren't they? Man-made things. See, there's more reasons for it than just the intellectual thing. It's the difference. So what are the proofs of creation? Evidence of design is everywhere. It is everywhere. You can start with the position of the earth. You can start with the oxygen and nitrogen in the air that we have, that we breathe. You can start with the birth of a baby. When a mother gives birth to a baby, she has placenta. What happens when the baby's born? Immediately. In fact, I've got a real video. Sometimes we'll show it to you. From a creationist guy. And he points out how when the baby is born, immediately there's some kind of protein or cell in the cell, whatever. It goes, boom, cuts off the blood flow to the womb. Otherwise, what would happen? How many millions of women or mothers or mammals or whatever in the ancient times gave birth to babies and that one thing didn't work right and so they died? You see, it's not just one thing. It's not just one screw bolt going on a nut. Or nut going on a bolt. Okay, sorry. Okay. It's not just one. It's not just one of those. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of things that have to happen exactly right, or we don't exist, including the power of gravity, including the speed of light, including the physical constants, all of them, of the universe. And it's not just, brethren, that you can, oh, well, I get in a range. You know, it's like in golf, you get close to the hole, that's pretty good, right? Or horseshoes, you know, you get close, that's pretty good. You can't just be close. It has to be exact or we perish. You know, brethren, design is a problem they have never, ever explained. They have never come up with it. They give you these myths. It's like the lawyer in court. He has no evidence, but he spins this possible story. You know, how this gun, well, maybe this gun was dropped by this guy, or maybe did this or that, or thus and such. You know, it's amazing. And by the way, have you ever heard of a story where the police, sadly, and they mean well maybe, but they start focusing on one person, and they think he's guilty, and then later on they find out it was somebody else? And they never really considered the evidence, where the evidence is not clear? In some cases, the evidence is pretty clear, and so it's obvious. But, you know, you get one of the worst things, unfortunately, we find out are eyewitnesses because, you know, the poor gal's under all this stress and she sees somebody and it's difficult. That's not sometimes the best thing under that condition. Now, if it's a relative that did that to her, it's different, see, because she recognizes him. That's a different thing. But if you have, you know, some stranger that's done, then it's difficult because, you know, think of the trauma and everything that's going on. And so you it's hard to remember somebody like that. So, you know, there are times when the evidence is not, you know, as good. All right. So, again, let's go to the thing of bacteria. By the way, we all have bacteria, don't we, huh? If you didn't have bacteria, you wouldn't live. In fact, you get your stomach and all these things have all these things going on in us. Enzymes and all that's got to be exactly right. Bacteria are some of the smallest. Some people don't even call them life, because they're really a parasite. You know, they have to live in us. You know, we're separate entities. We can live on our own and eat in them, but they're kind of a parasite or whatever. They have to live in something, and they're rather simple. But people have studied in Michael Behe's book, again, a quote from him. This is from page 69 of his book. We humans tend to have a rather exalted opinion of ourselves, and that attitude can color our perception of the biological world. In particular, our attitude about what is higher or lower in biology. Nonetheless, other organisms, if they could talk, could argue for their own superiority. This includes bacteria, which we often think of as the rudest forms of life. Wow. You ever thought of bacteria being better than you? But you know why. You know, bacteria have something in them that I don't know if we have in our body. It's called a flagellum. You ever heard of flagellum? Bacteria flagellum. It's a little tail. By the way, once you get your little handout I gave to you, okay? You see a picture of it in there. A bacteria flagellum. Look at that. God is the creator. Remember the handout here. Look at that little bacteria flagellum. You know, scientists have studied that. Before we had these microscopes and all this new stuff, we didn't know. You know, the human sperm, or the sperm of any animal, has this little tail, doesn't it? You've ever heard about it? It swims around. See, it's called a flagellum. In the bacteria, that is. I don't always call that in the sperm or whatever. But notice, it goes all kinds of ways. It can go one way or the other. And they have found, by the way, that it can be going thousands and thousands of rotations a second or whatever. A huge, incredible amount. You know how long it takes it to stop? 1/4 turn. Wow. Boy, would you like to have a boat like that? You know, you're going down, you know, or a car, you know, 1/4 length of the car, stop. We couldn't take the G's probably. We'd probably be blown out of our seatbelts even. But this little bacteria, it's not just that it has this flagellum. And guess what it has? at the base of it, see the little picture that I've got there at the base of it? That is a motor. By the way, you know, we got a motor in our car. A little electric motor would be a better analogy. The electric motors that run our air conditioners and all that stuff. That's what they've got at the base. And you can get diagrams of it. In fact, he's got a diagram of it here. And he shows it how it's got all this thing. And the proteins all get together in a certain way. Remember my new analogy of this? Thousands and thousands of times this happens. Like the screw that goes, the bolt that goes on, the nut that goes on the screw. Or nut that goes on the bolt, I should say. See, not only that, we're not talking about just a little simple bolt here, folks. We're talking about a very, you know, a machine that we hadn't invented as human beings. I don't know, you look up the date, 1800s, I would imagine, when the electric motor started. The photography started then, too, in the 1800s and whatever. But it's amazing, you know, this little flagellum is incredible. It's an incredible feature of it. This is from Encarta Encyclopedia. Many unicellular organisms swim, glide, thrash, or crawl to search for food and escape enemies. Swimming organisms often move by means of flagellum, a long tail-like structure made of protein. Many bacteria, for example, have one, two, or many flagella that rotate like propellers. So when you get your motorboat again, and you know, if you get a motorboat and a little propeller in the back, it'd be an electric motor in this case. Amazing. The eukaryotic flagellum works by waving up and down like a whip. In higher animals, the sperm cell uses flagellum to swim towards a female egg for fertilization. Now, okay. Now, Darwin said, and evolutionists believe, that life started out simple. Guess how old, in modern evolutionary geologic terms, bacteria are? You want to guess? Millions? 5 million? 10 million? You know where we have proven from the geologic record, according to them? I don't know if that's right, but according to their own books, 4 million years ago. 4 million, in fact, even more, I think, than that. It's amazing. It's amazing. In fact, I think it's 4 billion I meant to put here. I put 4 million. I think it's 4 billion, if I remember correctly. 4 billion. 4 billion. It's way back, because the Cambrian's 500 million. And that's, it's incredible. It is way, by the way, way I should probably put it so we're technically right here. It's one of the earliest forms, if not the earliest form of life we've found. And yet we know from today that these bacteria have flagellum. They're very intricate creatures. Yeah, you know, it's amazing. All right. So you can look it up and say, you know, all the stuff about it. It's amazing. Now, what about the geologic record? Darwin expected that when we started examining, remember he wrote about 1850, whatever the date is, middle 1800s, he wrote his book. They hadn't discovered a lot. I mean, geology was just starting, and if memory serves me correctly, was 1890 or something, when the dinosaurs, around the 1800s sometime, the dinosaurs, they started to find them, the dinosaurs, and they started to realize that there is a certain order of burial of these fossils. And that's true, by the way, brethren. Cambrian is basically found underneath, you know, where men are, you know, in the later Cenozoic, I think it would be called. And Cambrian in Paleozoic or whatever. Anyway, you can look it up. There's a certain order to the strata. Now, they're not everywhere on Earth, by the way, which the Grand Canyon is a good example of, but that's another point. But the point is that there's a certain order to them, and they started to discover that. However, Darwin said in his book, he says, we need to have a lot of intermediate species to prove our theory. And he expected that as time went along, that, aha, we would find, you know, these intermediate species between men and apes and all of that. And that's one of the problems, frankly, that they've had, brethren. They have not found in the geologic record these intermediate species, which you would expect. And by the way, the only objective way to prove evolution is by the geologic record. And by the way, brethren, if they do, and they may do that someday, by the way, I wouldn't be surprised if Scientific American doesn't come out and say, hey, we produced our first bacteria. I wouldn't be surprised. Because of what? But does that prove that God didn't create them? You see what it points to? When you get complexity in life, it points to a creator of so much greater intellect than ours, that, as the Bible says, to whom will you compare God? I mean, our brains, as I've mentioned before, have all these connections in all of this going on. Okay. And then this is a guy named Niles Eldredge. He is not a creationist. He is an evolutionist all the way. In the early 80s and 90s for a while, sometime there are people that advocated something called punctuated equilibrium. You know why? Let me read what he says about the geologic record then. This is a quote from Did Darwin Get It Wrong? A Nova special. It is indeed a very curious state of affairs, I think, that paleontologists have been insisting that their record is consistent with slow, steady, and gradual evolution. Okay, I'm going to stop here. Slow, gradual, they're saying that. Now, where I think that privately, they've known for over 100 years that such is not the case. It's the only reason they can correlate rocks with their fossils, for instance. They've ignored the question completely. And the question is, why don't we find gradual changes? What we do find is sudden creation. Exactly as we would say, especially we understand the gap theory and all of that, there were two creations. I mean, what we've understood in the church, brethren, makes much more sense than even the young earth creation position also, because of the enormity of the geologic record. All right. Now, that's another thing. A fossil is just a fossil. I mean, you don't have the living thing. And so you don't know. So, you ever heard of Lucy? Lucy was a fossil that was found by Donald Johansson in 1974. Only 40% of her skeleton was found. Now, I think they found some more. Okay? Lucy was supposed to be an intermediate between men and apes. All right? Lucy was supposed to be an intermediate. However, controversy about that started right away. Why? Because you only have the fossil. And in fact, when museums put Lucy up there, and they'll still put her up as an intermediate, they ignore something. You know what they ignore? An ape's fingers are longer than ours. For good reason, right? What do they do? Remember that poor lady that got killed by, was it a monkey or something? Chimpanzee, wasn't it? She didn't get killed. She got her face ripped off. Remember that? Hey, they're tremendous. Why are they tremendously strong? Because they go through trees, don't they? See, they're made differently. They're designed by God differently for a different thing. But what the evolutionists do is they forget. You know, they point out the similarities. And obviously, brethren, there are some similarities between us and apes. As far as, you know, we walk upright and we all do this, you know, this and that and thus and such. But there's a lot of differences, though, too. You know, I don't know of any ape that buries its dead. They don't. You know, they don't have fingers like ours. You know, this grasping, you know, it's different. The thumb, is different on theirs. And this is Hubert Way, Lucy's uncommon forebear, is quoted in that their words may be used against him by Henry Morris. This is a quote from this book. And this is somebody discussing Lucy. To make her point, Adrienne Zalman compares the pygmy chimpanzees to Lucy. Oh, wait a minute. Notice what he said. Compares the pygmy chimpanzee to Lucy, one of the oldest fossil hominids known. They're almost identical. That's Lucy now. Compared to a chimpanzee, they're almost identical in body size, in stature, in brain size, she notes. And the major difference is the hip and the foot represent the younger. This is a quote from an evolutionist. You know, at the Scopes trial, brethren, you talk about a disaster for the evolutionists. Remember Nebraska Man? You know one of the biggest things they Piltdown Man? You ever heard of him? Somebody glued a human jaw and an ape head together or opposite, whatever, look it up. Nebraska Man was a man based on a jaw found in Nebraska. I'm sure they're famous for that. Turned out it was a pig. But these are some of the items that were used to prove that evolution was true in the Scope trial in Tennessee. Remember that in the early 1900s? And William Jennings Bryan and this other guy go at it head to head. Oops. It didn't go on though, did it? You see the point? This is called the second law of thermodynamics. You know, closed cycle, please don't get too confused. Entropy increase. In other words, things rot. You know what I mean? Things get worse. What's most likely to happen? This thing is going to fall off, going to rust before it ever does get on there, get so rusty or whatever. Yeah, that's the whole point. But Lucy, guess what? Oh, but you go on National Geographic and History Channel and they say, oh boy, Johansson found this Lucy and it's a really interesting find and all of that. When members of their own, you know, the paleontologists themselves disagree. Okay. I mean, there's so many things we go into here, but we want to get on to. Oh, by the way, another one was Java Man. Java Man was another one that turned out to be wrong. Somebody else had that. And so it's always me. All right, the beginning of life in the geologic record is a place called the Cambrian. If you want to spell it, C-A-M-B-R-I-A-N. Called the Cambrian period. It is one of the earliest periods of life. This is from Encarta. Cambrian period, the first division of the Paleozoic era of the geologic time scale, spanning an interval of 70 million years, from 570 million to 500 million years. It was named in 1835 by English geologist Adam Sedgwick for sedimentary rocks in Wales, which the ancient Romans knew as Cambria. All right? So now we would expect if Darwin is right, we should find some real simple animals or creatures there, right? Wrong. Okay, in fact, Life magazine in 1995 had an article called When Life Exploded. And they actually discussed this as a problem for evolutionists. It's indeed, while most people cling to the notion that evolution works its magic over millions of years, scientists are realizing that biological changes often occurs in sudden fits and starts. Well, wait a minute, how does that work, Phil? You see, they have to have millions of years because then your mind kind of, I can't understand that. Okay, a lot of things that happen in millions of years. See, what's interesting, though, is that the laws of science haven't changed. Millions of years is another problem for them. If everything is by chance, why doesn't the law of gravity change? Why doesn't the speed of light change? Why doesn't Planck's constant change and all these things that work with the sun? All right? And none of these fitful starts, back to the article, was more dramatic nor productive than the mysterious one that one occurred shortly after Irwin's worm-like creature. And what they go on to say is this. All kinds of phyla are found there. One of the most interesting is a trilobite. You ever seen a trilobite? Well, why don't you go my little diagram, my little handout I gave you. Okay? See the trilobite? That's a fossil trilobite. They are not alive today. They've been dead for a long period of time. at the bottom of the first page. A little fossil trilobite. You know what's interesting about this trilobite? This one I don't think has. Oh, yeah, it may have. Do you see the eyes? Eyes. Remember, Darwin said, and evolutionists say, life started out simple. Wrong with bacteria. Billions of years old, you know, whatever. And also wrong with the trilobite, because guess what happened? This little trilobite has eyes. In fact, I think one university guy studied them and said they're compound eyes. Well, wait a minute. Darwin even said in his book, he says, eyes are so complex, brethren, they gave him a shudder. He can't figure out how to explain them. But wait a minute, what are they doing in the Cambrian? We are told by the evolutionists that everything is getting better. Oh, could it be, brethren, that there was a flood or floods that destroyed it, and the first animals to be buried are what? The sea creatures. In Salt Lake City, by the way, they got brine shrimp down at the bottom. If you had a flood that came there, the deer and the elk are up in the top of the mountains, right? They're running to the top. But the trilobites and the fish, they can't run anywhere. And the mud comes down, and guess what happens to them? First. Oh, there goes my bolt again. Okay. They're buried first, aren't they? Not only that, they tend to be heavier. And so the skeletons of the unopened deer may tend to float or be a little lighter or whatever. It's two or three things. And also there's a sorting that takes place. So, again, evolutionists are wrong again, aren't they? Not only that, others have stated that almost all the phyla are found. In other words, they're sea creatures, but they're similar to what we call phyla today, and that's just types of creatures, by the way. You don't have to get on that. All right. Compound eyes are even found in trilobites. All right. Here are the oops for the geologic column, then. I think I put that in the handout for you on the back page. These are oops. And I put a picture of the coelacanth. That's my own picture, by the way. From South Africa. East London Museum. That's the coelacanth right there. You know what's interesting about the coelacanth? These are oops. In other words, these are creatures that we find alive today. They're supposed to be dead. Coelacanth is supposed to have been dead for 70 million years. Well, he looks pretty good there, doesn't he? He's not a fossil either. It was found alive by a gal named Latimer in about 1938 off of East London, Texas. I'm Texas. Boy, I've changed the geography. East London, South Africa. Okay. East London, South Africa. You don't find them off of Texas. I know. But they also found some more. And you know what's interesting about them? Because evolutionists, by the fossil, you see those little fins that go down to the bottom? You know what the evolutionists were saying? What the coelacanth was? That they walked on the bottom of the ocean, and that they are predecessors to land animals. In fact, they'll put it in these big words when you read coelacanth and say, well, it proved something was wrong. And they decide to say, well, now we were proven wrong, so therefore we're still right. Well, no. This proves that you could be wrong on everything. Because what happened later, a guy named Frick, he was a German scientist, went off of South Africa and started looking for them. And guess what he found? That when they search for food, they're down at the bottom. So they're way deep in the ocean. Maybe, I would assume, a mile deep or something, just like they think this plane might have gone down. They're way deep in the ocean. You can't bring them up because somebody did. They brought it up and it died because they're used to the pressure of the ocean. They can't live on the surface. But they thought, the evolutionists said, on the basis of fossils. Now here's an important point. On the basis of fossils, you can't tell for sure what this creature does, what this fish does. And what he does, he goes at the bottom of the ocean like this, and he takes his nose and apparently has something like radar, something like a dolphin, some kind of electromagnetic thing, and he goes down to the bottom and searches for food. He doesn't walk on the bottom. These fins have nothing to do with walking, which is what they said early on. Wrong. And I've got, I didn't put the picture in here, but I've got a picture of the East London News. I think it's, maybe it's the Cape Time, Cape Town, South Africa is close to there. Not too far from there, by the way. Maybe a couple hundred miles, whatever, but they had a big article, you know, living fossil found or something like that. Extinct fish found. Because it was a big deal. And you know, brethren, years ago in the church, I wrote a paper on geology. And this is one of the examples I used. You know, we had somebody in the church who was basically advocating, you know, didn't really believe that Adam and Eve existed, or if they did, they were whatever, didn't quite believe that they were the founders and had all these unfortunately evolutionary type of scenarios. I really didn't believe in a universal flood. And that's what they told me, too, by the way. I got a letter from them, by the way, that they told me that in WCG days years ago. And it was so interesting. So I brought up the coelacanth. You know what the answer was I got on the paper? So what? So what? Guy, he's found there with a gun, you know, just shot at smoking. And, you know, I didn't shoot her. You see, so what? So what? It shows clearly, and brother, it's not just one. It turns out that coelacanth itself are several places deep in the ocean. Oh, do we have an explanation for why they wouldn't be found in the upper strata with humans and others? And the monkeys and the whales and all of that? Yes! Because it's deep in the ocean. And what's going to be buried first when you have mud come down and all this stuff? And the waters get polluted, maybe by volcanoes and stuff in the flood. And matter comes and covers them. What's going to be buried earlier? The coelacanth, the poor creature, lives deep in the ocean. Mudslides came down, by the way, probably from the land even. It's a simple explanation. It fits very well with the flood. That's the reason they're not found. You know, it's incredible. It's not just one. Just a few years ago, they found a deer that they thought was extinct, I think in Vietnam somewhere. One of the most recent ones, by the way, was the Malami tree in Africa, in Australia. It was right outside of Sydney. And you can see the story. In fact, the ranger who found it, you know what he said it was like finding? And I have to dig up the quote for you. You know what he said, though? It's like finding a living dinosaur. Because he lived at the same time. So did coelacanth. They lived at the same time the dinosaurs did. Well, you see, something's wrong with this evolutionary interpretation of the geologic record. And I give you a list of them here. Neoplanina is just some kind of a oyster or whatever, a mollusk. Tuatara is kind of a lizard. They found an island that's been extinct for millions of years, according to them. A ginkgo tree is another tree, and a sea lily. And the sea lily, and also there are creatures that have not changed through time. That's another problem for them. Why don't they change if they adapt? Here they are the same. And then, you know, as we conclude this sermon, brethren, you know, keep in mind, what are one of the greatest proofs against evolution? I mean, kind of summarizing it. Point number one, I would say complexity. Complexity. You can't put this nut on this bolt. And by the way, that's the simplest one. As I mentioned before, this is simple. Much more complex things have to happen for life. By the way, bacteria, which has an electric motor. Imagine how many times and how many things has to happen before that electric motor works right. You know, complexity. Point number two, you might put, you could probably get a whole bunch of points, but point number two would be the geologic record does not confirm evolution. The geologic record points to creation. It points to the sudden appearance, perhaps millions of years ago, perhaps thousands of years ago. I don't know if we know for sure. But it shows. And two things. One is the very earliest things have bacteria, which is extremely complex, probably about 4 billion years ago. We find it in the rocks, evidence of bacteria, and the Cambrian explosion. And then you go to outer place fossils. So those are very, and also, brethren, proofs for creation. Again, complexity. You know, complex things are designed. And creatures are designed, like trilobites, by God, for a specific purpose to live deep in the ocean and or in the sea, just like land animals. Science does not confirm the theory of evolution. But science, actually, when you understand it correctly and look at it through the simple eyes and exclude all the theories of men, science, brethren, confirms that there was a creation, that there is a designer, that we have a purpose, and that there is a God. And that, brethren, is an important thing to remember. And also, it has a great ramification on how we live our lives. Because if there is a God, which the evidence points to, then there's a reason why God created us. And that's another part of the story for another day. So again, in conclusion, science does confirm creation.